This is Coffee and Cardiology.
In this podcast, we sit down with a faculty from the University of Washington Division of Cardiology to discuss the very latest in diagnostics, therapeutics, and as a special bonus, we ask what makes our cardiologists tick.
All right, Jim, take it away.
Well, we are really fortunate to actually bring on Chris Berg. Before we ask him to go through his journey in medicine, I'll note that he is our premier aortic surgeon and co-director of the MTAP program, as well as the associate program director for the cardiothoracic surgery residency. But Chris, in addition to all those accolades, what has been your journey through medicine that brought you to this point?
Well, first of all, thank you, John Michael, Jim. It's a pleasure to be on. I know we've been trying to do this for a while. I was solo this weekend with a 4 and 1 year old, so if I seem tired or haggard or off my game a little bit, that's exactly why. So it's great to be here, and thank you for the kind words. So I did my training out here. So I graduated medical school at the University of Michigan, and it was at the beginning of a little bit of a transition in the United States with cardiothoracic surgical training. And University of Washington was one of the first, what's called integrated programs, so where you go directly from medical school into training. And Dr. Kathleen Burfield was the first resident to do that here, and she's currently our program director and our lead thoracic surgeon over at the VA hospital. And she was the first resident that had done it, so she was in her first year when I interviewed. And I interviewed out here, fell in love with the place, fell in love with Seattle, really enjoyed the people and culture within the University of Washington, and was fortunate enough to match out here. So I did my cardiothoracic surgical training, again, straight from medical school, 6 clinical years. I did a year of research. And if that wasn't enough training, I decided to do a little bit of sort of finishing school and got some advanced training in aortic surgery at the University of Pennsylvania under the direction of Dr. Joe Bavaria, and then was fortunate enough to come back here and join faculty now 5 years ago, which is pretty wild to say out loud. So I've been mostly occupying my clinical and research time in the aortic surgical space. And we have seen, I think, really tremendous growth that we're proud of, and brought on another cardiac surgeon, Scott DeRue, to help out with some of the aortic surgery, and have great partnerships with cardiology, obviously, but also genetics and vascular surgery that I'm sure we'll touch on as well. So 5 years later, it's somehow gone in a blink of an eye, and here we are. So again, thanks for having me on.
Well, it actually was a huge coup on our part to bring you on here, because someone who is so highly trained in what is actually a pretty narrow field, this is something that you don't sort of run into every day. There's cardiothoracic surgery, and a lot of surgeons work on the aorta, but what you do kind of is of the most specialized nature. Do you want to go into that a little bit for our listeners?
Absolutely. So I think, at least in surgery, historically, there was maybe a little bit of a mindset for surgeons to be as broad clinically as possible, and it was almost a badge of honor. You know, I'm maybe a general surgeon that does everything, and cardiac surgery, I think, was no exception. So I think, again, in previous generations of surgeons, there was this idea that it was a good thing to do everything and be good at everything. I think probably in the past decade or so, there's been a little bit of a paradigm shift in that a little bit. I actually credit one of my mentors, Joe Bavaria, in the aortic space, who I would say should give deserve some credit for pushing this forward in terms of aortic. But more and more, especially in tertiary care academic centers like the University of Washington, there's been a push to really hyper-specialize surgical services. And I think it makes perfect sense. I'm certainly biased, but it makes perfect sense in that the thing that we can offer patients is a very, very hyper-specialized practice. And so we take care of some of the most complex issues that come from all over the Pacific Northwest, but really even West Coast. And we have a variety of surgical expertise here to really have a narrow practice. So for me, about 95% of what I do is wrapped up in the aortic valve and aorta. In fact, we were just talking, I was earlier today at a high school talking to some high school students, and we were kind of going over everything, and then we finally got to the aortic valve portion of the dissection, and I explained to them that pretty much my entire life professionally is wrapped up in this structure right here, what we're looking at. And again, I think the mind shift has gone from I do everything, and it's awesome that I do everything, to I do a few things, but I do them really well. And that's what we have transitioned into. And so there's a little bit of humility that comes with it. When there's other things that maybe aren't in my area of expertise, I'm totally fine involving other colleagues or even passing those particular cases on. And I think, to me, that makes the most sense. I think in any other thing that we do in life, the more you do of a specific task, the better you get. And I don't understand why heart surgery would be any different.
Well, I think that is of great benefit to our patients, frankly, especially in this space, because there's a lot of cardiac surgery that can be done. There's a lot of subspecialty, but this space in particular that seems so dynamic and is really pushing the boundaries, I think, in ways that we really haven't thought of before, is, I would guess, requiring a lot of this special expertise. It's not just about putting a graft in there to repair a dissection anymore, is it?
Not at all. So the aortic valve has seen a lot of changes, as you point out, in terms of how we think about replacing valves, but really also repairing valves, which is kind of new on the aortic valve space. So mitral valve repair has been something that's been recognized as being a benefit for patients for many, many years now. Aortic valve, for a variety of reasons, has lagged very far beyond that. And even when I was in training, I mean, now we're only talking 10 or 15 years ago, you know, the options were a bioprosthetic or a mechanical aortic valve replacement. I mean, patients that came in with aortic valve and, for the most part, even aortic root pathology, those were your options. You got two options. And, it erred on most younger patients would opt for a mechanical valve, and older patients would get a bioprosthetic valve. And those are still good options for some patients, but we have definitely recognized that there are certain patient populations that benefit from other more sort of novel therapies that can either be repairing aortic valves. This is especially true with a leaky bicuspid aortic valve, and we do lots and lots of valve repairs now, and even other options to replace a valve. So something like a Ross procedure, where we use a valve on the right side of the heart, the pulmonic valve, and move it over into the aortic position. For aneurysmal disease, especially in the aortic root, we're very keen to do valve-sparing approaches for those patients. There's a variety of techniques for that. And this whole idea of restoring valve function and really the living valve complex with either a valve repair or a Ross procedure, we think has a lot of benefits. And there's been a lot of data that's come out in the past 10 years or so to support that practice. And it makes it an exciting time, no doubt. So patients now, especially our younger middle-aged patients, have a lot more options. And you're right that it requires a not only surgical expertise, but also a team expertise, right? Mm-hmm. It really is an entire village to have a successful practice like this. And so I'm only really one small cog in a much bigger system. And I think it's also important to recognize that.
A pretty central cog, nonetheless. If you're not doing this and doing it well, it isn't going to happen. Could you maybe walk us through a little bit of some of the decision-making? Because it always strikes me that there's the technical aspect of surgery. That's the baseline. You got to have that. But it really is the decision-making of who to operate on, which operation to do. So how do you sort of decide, for instance, when to use the Ross procedure? Sure. I remember even in my career, the Ross has gone up, it's gone down. It's like some people love it, other people hate it. And then the David Five procedures, as you mentioned, the valve sparing procedures that have been developed. How do you make those choices for patients? Sure.
It's an excellent question. So the first thing, I think the main thing, and a lot of times when I give talks, the fundamental point, the talk that I'm trying to give is that the patient with aortic valve disease who is older than, I don't know, let's arbitrarily say 65 years old, which is a bit arbitrary, but let's use 65. That's a fundamentally different patient than an aortic valve patient that comes in less than 65. It's totally different. The problems are different and the therapies are different. So for our patients over 65, we won't say older, we'll just say for our more advanced age patients over 65, this is an entirely different way of thinking, right? We're thinking TAVR or in for surgical AVR, you know, we're thinking bioprosthetic valves almost predominantly, almost exclusively, and the lifelong valve paradigm in that patient is much different than the patient less than 65. The patient less than 65 is a completely separate category, and they must be thought of as a separate way. These are very, very often bicuspid aortic valve patients now. We're seeing less and less rheumatic heart disease, you know, endocarditis and things like that. But oftentimes when you're seeing these folks in the clinic, they're bicuspid patients. And so that's kind of the fundamental first sort of branch point in our thinking. For our younger middle-aged patients, again, it's a bit arbitrary to simply use age, but for the younger cohort, the first thing we're looking at is the function of the valve. So is the valve stenotic? Is it calcified? Is it thickened? Or is the valve regurgitant? Or does the valve work well? And maybe it's just an innocent bystander in the case of say, an aortic root aneurysm or something like that. A valve that is thickened, calcified, fibrotic will typically have aortic stenosis, and any significant degree of aortic stenosis really realistically, for the most part, excludes any valve sparing or valve repair approaches. There are some things that we occasionally do with leaflet reconstruction and things like that, but that's a little bit on the frontier here. Those patients often need valve replacement. And again, so that you've got a bioprosthetic valve, you've got a mechanical valve, or in that case, a Ross procedure. So that is the sort of bread and butter Ross patient that we're going to be looking at. Younger, middle-aged patient, usually less than 60, 65 years old. We like to see aortic stenosis predominant. That's actually helpful, and there's data to suggest that that's a better patient to do a Ross procedure in. On the flip side, a normal functioning valve, you know, bicuspid tri-leaflet valve, or a predominantly aortic regurgitant valve, so a leaky aortic valve, can oftentimes be repaired. And this is especially true in the case of a bicuspid valve, actually. So with or without root aneurysm, a regurgitant bicuspid valve can often be repaired through a variety of techniques. As you point out, we tend to do a lot of valve sparing root replacements or David 5 procedures here with a bicuspid repair. The most common anatomy that we're seeing is what's called a Sievers 1 bicuspid valve, which has one fusion point, one raphe, and often that conjoined fused leaflet will prolapse a little bit. I've nicknamed that lesion set, that's the P2 prolapse of the aortic valve. That's a very, very repairable situation. We love to see that, especially when we have nice surface area in a fairly symmetric valve. That's a great, great protoplasm for valve repair. And we think that those are quite durable repairs. And then it boils down to any kind of associated aneurysmal disease from there. So we're looking at obviously the valve, but also the aorta, because, you know, of course, a lot of these bicuspid patients will also have some degree of aortopathy, and basically fixing whatever aorta is dilated or diseased.
Well, when you are getting into that aorta space, how does that play into doing all of this work?
Yeah, so the aorta obviously is a huge structure, right? Spans multiple body cavities. So obviously any of the, you know, aortic root structure, which is going to be intimately associated with the aortic valve, the coronary arteries in the heart, that's obviously in the cardiac surgeon's domain. I mean, there's no operation that you do there that doesn't involve, you know, the heart-lung machine or anything like that. Once you get past the aortic arch into the descending thoracic aorta, down through the diaphragm into the abdominal aorta, there somewhere along that path, there's a little bit of a demarcation point where, you know, the vascular surgeons, you know, tend to take sort of primary and more of the abdominal aorta. You know, again, that territory is probably somewhere around the diaphragm. I think it's a little less useful to think of this is mine, this is yours type of thing. And this gets into the MTAP or multidisciplinary thoracic aortic program concept that we have. And certainly here at the University of Washington, and I think the ideal situation is that most of these cases are thought of in kind of a joint multidisciplinary fashion, where again, it's not, the pathology goes into this area, so this is my patient, you know, versus you get patient B. But actually, how do we set this patient up for sort of lifelong aortic therapy, right? And it may be certain things, certain elements are done via open surgery and some are done via stents, right? And at this point, a lot of pathology in the abdominal aorta and even in the descending thoracic aorta, and now even a little bit into the aortic arch are done with stent grafts. So they're done sort of hand in hand with our vascular surgeons. And this is where it's critical to form these collaborations and to tackle these patients in a multidisciplinary fashion, because there's no good sort of one size fits all for this type of thing. So, you know, it's all about teamwork and again, that hyper-specialization and putting our best foot forward for patients and thinking of sometimes creative solutions. But you're absolutely right. I mean, this is very much a team sport.
Yeah, this is such a good point to bring up, because I think for many cardiology practitioners, that the aorta is a tube. It doesn't have the same level of complexity of the heart. It doesn't have innovation in nerves, and it, you know, no valves and stuff like that. So it's just this very simple structure. But nothing could be further from the truth. And the reality is, especially with all the things that are going on, you outlined so much of what's in the proximal aorta, but even within the rest of it, the complexity of this structure and the things that are involved really require that MTAP team. So I'm wondering if you could just sort of describe MTAP a little bit more, who's involved, what's involved, and sort of, I guess, further illustrate some of this complexity that we deal with every week.
Yeah, absolutely. So the MTAP program, and I have to give, you know, Dr. Matt Sweet, one of our vascular surgery colleagues, a lot of credit here, who I think he had the vision in multiple different points in time to form collaborations and to team up with our cardiac surgeons. And when I was brought on, because I had that focus in aorta, and that was really going to be my area of interest in my area to help program build on the cardiac side, you know, we came together and helped, I think, formalize this relationship a little bit, put a name to it, organize it a little bit better. And what it has evolved into is a weekly case conference. And so, again, pretty much all the patients with pathology in basically the aortic arch or downward are discussed in a multidisciplinary fashion. This really started out with maybe two or three surgeons this was pre-COVID, so meeting in person, and it's now sort of morphed into kind of a hybrid sort of virtual setting. But that has changed from just a couple surgeons to now pretty much every week we've got several geneticists on, several cardiologists on. Like I said, there's now two cardiac surgeons, three, sometimes four vascular surgeons. I mean, plus program support, you know, PAs, nurse practitioners, patient care coordinators, sort of all sorts of things to help organize some of the complex care for these patients. So we're incredibly proud that even in a few years, this has gone from a bit of kind of a ragtag, I sort of liken it to almost like a startup, you know, and has built into something where on a weekly basis, we may have 10, 15, 20 people logging in. And we're really diving into things on these patients. You know, I mean, we're getting into the genetics, right? And having Dr. Peter Byers and his colleagues really, you know, going over the the genetic abnormalities and what they mean and how they influence the care and thought process for these particular patients. It's helpful to have the cardiologist on there. And then we talk about, you know, potential surgery, but sometimes it's really not just a surgical case conference. I mean, it's more of an aortic planning and aortic care conference. And that's a point that I try and communicate to people, is that I don't look at myself simply as just kind of a see aorta, fix aorta type of individual or type of doctor. I mean, I want to be an aortic and aortic valve doctor. And when someone comes to me, a lot of times they don't need surgery, right? Right. They need observation, or they need counseling, or in terms of, you know, getting genetics and having family members screened, and what does that mean, and what does it mean for them moving forward, right? The surgery, it's a big piece, but it's only one piece, again, in the care of these patients, and we recognize that. And instead of just sort of people kind of bouncing around in the system, and you're with the surgeon at the time of surgery, and then you sort of never see the surgeon again, and you go off and see this person, and then you see that person, we're trying to centralize that care a little bit. So when somebody comes in, we meet as a team, we discuss the pertinent issues, we figure out who they need to see and when, and we go from there. And again, that there are so many folks that are critical to that in terms of the organization and all these different appointments and visits and what we have to do and the plan and things like that. And so it really does take a village, and we're very proud of how that's come together. It's pretty unique. I mean, I can tell you around the country, there's you can imagine the amount of egos that are involved here, especially when you get a few surgeons in a room, and we could certainly tell you stories. And here, sort of all that stuff gets checked at the door. We have a great working relationship. It's not a turf war thing. It's all about what is the best plan for the patient. How do we take great care of this person? And I'm proud of sort of the humility that everybody brings to that group. And it's been a wonderful thing to watch it grow.
Well, I can really attest to that. That is very true. These are very helpful and patient focused conferences that happen, which is amazing. I wonder if you could give us a few more insights about why genetics. I mean, isn't just big aorta, fix aorta a sort of concept? And from the surgeon's perspective in particular, why do you need to know what that genetic deletion or whatever it is?
Yeah, it certainly historically was sort of big aorta, fix aorta. And look, to a certain extent, it still sort of is. But the bottom line is, we know and we understand that a vast majority of aortic aneurysmal disease that we see is somehow genetically driven, especially in a younger patient population. You know, right now there's probably about 30 gene mutations or so that we can screen for. And the most common condition that folks have heard of is obviously Marfan syndrome, but that's really just one. That happens to be the most common genetic aortopathy.
And Marfans multiple. For the layperson.
What's that?
Marfans. What is
Marfans.
That?
Marfan. So Marfan syndrome is a clinical syndrome that arises from mutations in what's called the FBN1 mutation. So that's a sort of connective tissue mutation, and causes a variety of syndromic features. So skeletal issues like a pectus can cause some eye issues. But what's pertinent to us is it can lead to aortic aneurysms, especially at the aortic root level, right by the heart, which can lead to dissections. So both type A dissections and type B dissections further along in the aorta. But the point is, you know, Marfan syndrome is just one of many. And what I tell patients, you know, I'll have somebody sitting in my office who's maybe 50 years old and has had an aortic dissection themselves and has multiple family members who have had aortic issues. And we talk about genetic testing. And I say, look, here's the bottom line. I'm convinced that you have a genetic aortopathy, number one. The question is, I don't know that your genetic testing will be positive, right? All that means is that we've either recognized, you know, these 30 genes that you have, or whatever's going on at your sort of cell and molecular level, we haven't discovered yet. And so the bottom line is, we're learning more and more all the time on this. And I think it's only a matter of time that the care will get more tailored and individualized. And it does have impacts. It has huge impacts on family members, because member people can get screened for these conditions and understand, like, let's say you have siblings or children and you're wondering, are they at risk for aortic aneurysmal disease and dissections? So they can get screened. And it also has treatment. It impacts treatment decisions, how we think about things surgically, how we look at other areas of the vasculature to screen for aneurysms, say in the brain or in other areas. So this is a critically important piece. And the bottom line is, every patient in my clinic who has an aortic root aneurysm gets offered genetic screening. That includes bicuspid patients, by the way. I've completely changed to that. And if anyone's young or has had an aortic dissection, they're offered genetic screening. I think in 2023, this is an absolutely essential part of the workup.
That's a really, really great point. And also, from hearing some of you describe what the tissue actually looks like in some of these genetic aortopathies, it seems like that's also a pretty important thing to know going in.
Yeah, I think you want to have some idea of what you're getting yourself into. Again, occasionally we're surprised. You may think that things are going to be really difficult and handle very challenging, and sometimes that's not always the case. But there are certainly conditions, aortopathies, where your radar is a little heightened for that. And again, it does get into a planning thing. I mean, I think a certain degree of spontaneity in life is good, and I certainly enjoy that. However, when I'm operating on hearts, I like to have a pretty good idea of what we're getting ourselves into. And that gets into the planning phase. And I think that's probably the best thing, to have some idea of sort of what things are going to look like.
What are you looking out for? Is it just really thin? Are you worried about, what does that look like?
Yeah, it can be very thin. And especially when you're talking about, delicate things, like, for example, when we do an aortic root replacement, you're taking the coronary arteries off and taking off what we call little buttons. So they're little buttons of aortic tissue, right? And you have to do whatever operation you're doing and put those back on, of course. And that tissue can be very, very thin and fragile, right? And if I know that coming in, it may be a circumstance where I might harvest a little bit of the patient's own pericardium, right? And you take a little bit of a strip of reinforcing pericardium, right? And these are just little things on the front end that you're looking at. But yeah, the tissue can be very thin. It can tear very easily. So when we're suturing it, if you're not very, very precise with how that needle tip and needle is going through, it can form little tears, and that can lead to problems. So maybe you put a little piece of felt on some of your other anastomoses to kind of reinforce them. So it's sort of all these little things. But the bottom line is, it's sort of, you want to assume that it's always going to be delicate, and do your A+ effort, and most of the time it should go just fine.
It sounds like these can be very long operations.
They can be. They certainly can be. That's one thing. When we talk, for example, Ross procedure. I mean, it's no question, a pretty complicated operation. And the bottom line is, when you do something like that, doing a conventional aortic valve replacement, you might be on bypass for an hour, maybe 70, 80 minutes. We're doing a Ross procedure, we'll often have the cross clamp on for 2-3 hours, bypass for 3-3.5 hours, doing a lot of work. And there's a lot of opportunity for things to go wrong. This gets into the specialized aspect of everything that we talked about early. So for some of these things, there's a relatively simple, with air quotes, but a relatively technically straightforward alternative. And that does get into your decision-making a little bit. And that's why we want to have these focus programs. We want to have a little bit of repetition here, because we recognize that these are more complex options, than the alternative, and you can find yourself into trouble. So absolutely, some of these extensive aneurysm repairs and valve, repairs, replacements can be big, long operations. Again, if you focus on it and have a specialized practice, then I think you can have reproducible results.
Yeah.
Well, and you've been now growing this program and talking specifically about the Ross. I'm one of the leading operators of the Ross in the country at this point. Can you talk about, I think there's a history of the Ross having kind of had its time and had a bit of a valley and now is picking back up. Can you talk about that history and where we're at as a program?
Yeah, you can cut off my mic if this gets too long, because this is a very long and winding road. I'll try and give the Cliff Notes version. But bottom line is the Ross procedure is actually a very old cardiac operation. So Donald Ross, I believe, did the first in 1967. Don't quote that, but I'm pretty sure of that number. It is a very good aortic valve replacement option in kids, and that was sort of the original intent. Idea being that the pulmonary valve that you move over, which is called the autograft, can actually grow with the patient, which is obviously very, very helpful in kids where you don't have, the structures are smaller, so putting in a small prosthetic valve is not so good, right? That obviously doesn't grow with the patient. There's a time in the 90s that I call sort of first wave Ross enthusiasm. There was a lot of interest in it. A lot of folks were doing it in adults. Now we're kind of talking adults here. And what was found in sort of the early 2000s, in sort of early 2010s, was there was some publications coming out that had really two main concerns. There was concern that the autograft dilated over time, which could lead to the new aortic or neo-aortic valve becoming leaky. So that was a sort of long-term valve concern. But probably the final nail in sort of first wave Ross coffin was a publication that came out looking at STS data that showed that the perioperative or surgical mortality rate was higher with a Ross, quite a bit times, like three times higher for Ross procedure versus conventional aortic valve replacement. And that publication came out in 2014, I believe. And that more or less ended first wave Ross. And so folks, I mean, it was already a hard operation. And so I think a lot of people were probably looking for an excuse to sort of stop doing it anyway. And it was felt that it was unsafe and had this issue long term of the autograft dilating. Now, the devil's always in the details. And so some folks that persisted through this kind of end of first wave noticed a few things. Number one, that the high perioperative mortality was largely driven by low-volume centers. And in that publication, the average number of Ross procedures was one done per year. And we absolutely know that that is no good. That if you're going to be a center that does this operation, you need to do a lot of repetitions. Bottom line, there's no question about that. This is a complex operation. So that was kind of the first bit. And centers that persisted and continued to do the Ross procedure, could do it safely with perioperative outcomes, so at the time of surgery outcomes that were equivalent to conventional AVR. So that's kind of condition number one. You've got to do it safely, and it was shown that you can do it safely if you do it enough and you have the requisite skill set. But the second thing that was recognized is that there are a variety of ways to mitigate this issue with autograft dilation. And this gets into many technical factors that have been developed over time and sort of recognized over time, but also gets into some medical things. So one of the things that is extremely important is your blood pressure postoperatively. So we are very, very cognizant of patients' blood pressure for even up to a year out from a Ross procedure, right? So the pulmonary valve obviously exists in a lower pressure environment. So moving it over to the systemic circulation exposes it to higher pressures. And we don't want to have undue high blood pressure that the autograft is being exposed to. So we're very, very picky about patients' blood pressure, and it's not uncommon to have folks discharge on multiple blood pressure agents. There are other things that we can do that are termed quote-unquote protected Rosses. So this is a variety of Dacron rings and bands and even full what we call sort of jackets where you implant the autograft within a Dacron graft, and that can decrease or eliminate dilation over time. And so all these things were learned, these lessons learned from sort of first wave, Ross, as I put, and the folks that persisted in sort of the 2018, 2019, 2020 time frame started publishing excellent long-term data. I mean, very, very good long-term data, by the way, from all over the world, right? So this is not one or two surgeons, one or two centers. This is stuff from all over the world, many, many different continents, and showed excellent long-term results. So, you know, the Achilles heel, which would be a valve reintervention rate, on the order of about 1% per year. So you go out, we've got 20-year data where it looks like about 20 to 25% of patients need a valve reintervention. You know, you turn that on the head, about three-quarters of patients are without needing a valve reintervention. That's incredible. That's 20 years. You know, you compare that to a bioprosthetic valve, which is pretty much 100% at that time frame. And then the most important thing, and I think the most compelling thing, is the survival seems to be excellent. And the survival seems to be on par with the general population, which is truly incredible. And you cannot say the same thing about mechanical valves and bioprosthetic valves. So that data, which is now about 5 or 6 years old, you know, that kind of round of data led to a resurgence of interest in what I call sort of second wave ROS, which is we're very much on the uptick of sort of second wave ROS. And I'm happy about the fact that here at the University of Washington, I think we recognized what we were seeing, you know, in terms of these folks that persisted and recognized that data. We have the patient population here to support a healthy program. I mean, that's the most important thing. I mean, if you hardly ever see young and bicuspid patients, I mean, sort of you're not going to build a program, and we have that volume. And I think we have the surgical expertise, you know, to do this. And this was a partnership that I formed with Dr. David Mockley, who's our surgical director of adult congenital heart disease. And he had experience with the ROS procedure at a previous job. And in 2020, we had a couple patients lined up who we felt would be perfect candidates for it. And we sort of teamed up surgical expertise and let it rip. And here we are about 90 or so ROSs later and really happy with the state of where that stands.
That is incredible. I think that's the price of listening to the podcast right here to get that summary of the ROS, the history of the ROS. You need to write that up and publish it in some way, because that was incredible.
I've thought about this before.
You clearly.
Well, what other research and work are you doing to advance that now? Third wave.
Well, so this is where things get really interesting, because here we are. And everyone's talking about this in cardiac surgery. And there's a subset of folks that are rolling their eyes and are still sort of non-believers. There are some folks who are maybe a little bit zealots about it and maybe a little bit overly enthusiastic. And I hope that I'm somewhere in the middle, although I'm probably not, but I hope to be sort of level-minded about it. And here's the bottom line. We may just be repeating history. Right? We may just be repeating history, or we maybe have learned lessons from before and have built have built healthy, sustainable programs. This is my hope. And we're going to be able to replicate, you know, those data from Center of Excellence. I think we do that here at the University of Washington. I think there are a lot of programs around the country that are able to replicate that. I have concerns that there's some that maybe don't, and time will tell. So one of the things that we're doing is we are recognizing the importance of collaboration, and we've formed research consortiums with other centers around the country, UPenn, Northwestern, Baylor, places that do similar ROS volumes, and are in the process of pooling data, you know, kind of retrospective but also prospective patient tracking. And this, I think, may ultimately get into an idea and concept of, do we need things like designations and centers of excellence and sort of mandated reporting and things like that, right? Similar to what you might see on transplant or something like that, something along those lines. And again, we're trying to be proactive and on the front end of that, because I think we owe that to our patients. And I tell every single patient, valve repair, Ross, whatever, when they come in, that this is kind of a lifelong commitment. I mean, I want to follow that patient as the surgeon for life. And obviously people move, they you know, relocate. And I tell them that it's my commitment to that we will continue to keep eyes on them and track them down and track down their echoes, with the intent that we need to understand that 5, 10, 15, 20 years out, what we're doing is actually the right thing to do, right? And we do not declare victory when the patient's discharged from the hospital.
Yeah, that is remarkable in the history of medicine and the history of surgery, this idea that you would look that far out, be interested, use that data to help others, and invite the patient along in that generation of the data through these registries. I mean, that is an incredibly important work that you're involved in. It opens up so many opportunities to look, as you said, at the imaging data that's going to be coming out of that, to be able to figure out some of the whys behind this and to be able to track over time and see what happens.
Absolutely. You know, and there's many, many different layers to that. You know, I'm sure there's opportunities for advanced imaging to help predict which pulmonary valves will do well, for example, in a Ross, or which maybe bicuspid valves or whatever will do well with repair versus what are features that don't. I mean, right now it's very rough. I mean, we're clearly, I think, on the front end of sort of the knowledge of all of this. And it's a lot of sort of these principles and these rules that we live by, but there's no question that there's more opportunity for advanced imaging, not just afterwards, you know, surveying patients, but also to predict, you know, who's a good substrate for X, Y, or Z, or what are, you know, imaging characteristics that might steer us away from certain interventions.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I want to bring up an issue that we have dealt with, the two of us, with some patients here, and I think it is a very interesting decision-making thing that comes up, particularly in aortic surgery. So you have the situation in which someone has a large-ish aorta, no problems in terms of clear genetic definition. You mentioned we don't know all the genes at this point, so there's a lot out there. People have big aortas and no genetic abnormalities, at least that we know of. And the question comes up, I'm getting older, surgery is going to be more dangerous the older I get, I don't quite meet the thresholds, but why not get it over with now? Especially when, you know, gosh, if I had dissect, I could have a major debilitating stroke or die or something like that.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. So that one comes up, you know, quite a bit. And I think, to be honest, I have no clear and straightforward, you know, answer when that arises. I think there's a lot of factors that go into it. You know, if someone's 60 years old and tells me that, I kind of reassure them that, you know, they're going to be well within the window of sort of safe cardiac surgery for the foreseeable future. And you know, that's really not an age concept that becomes a concern. When someone progresses along their 70s, it really becomes an individualized discussion. And again, age is certainly one thing, but family history is important. You know, the absolute size of the aneurysm is one thing, but then this gets into the concept of, well, what about size indexing for height and body surface area and things like this? So at that point, I'm trying in my head as best as possible to really understand how clinically significant is this dilated aorta. I mean, is this something that in this patient in front of me is likely to impact their life or likely not? You know, they will die with it, not of it, type of thing. And that's a very imperfect science. I mean, the bottom line is if somebody is close, right, is close to meeting that sort of guideline criteria or has these other factors that I think make them higher risk, and they are maybe moving along into their 70s, that's a conversation that we have, right? And it And again, it's not just sort of an age thing, but I think for some patients who are in that scenario, it's a little bit of a, I'd kind of like to move on beyond this and sort of get this behind me so that I can focus on the things, my goals, you know, for the remainder of my life and sort of not hopefully have to deal with this too much. And I'm cognizant of that. Interestingly, when patients get older, then it is a totally different conversation, right? Of a pure aneurysm operation, that's a prophylactic operation, right? That's a life-extending operation to prevent an aortic catastrophe. And there's some point where it's really not worth it, you know, to do it. You know, whatever, again, it varies for particular patients. But I mean, as someone progresses along their 80s or certainly into their 90s, we're really not thinking about doing a prophylactic open heart operation in those patients. So this gets into the art of medicine. A lot of sort of a little bit deeper conversations that we have other than it is 5.5 centimeters or it's not 5.5 centimeters. I mean, people are telling me, you know, about their life and their goals and what they want to do and when. And usually you talk to folks and you can help guide them, I think, into an agreeable solution for that particular patient. There's lots of things that go into it, you know, no doubt.
That's a phenomenal answer. This is a commercial for registries and finding out more that'll help us refine this. But also brings up the fact that MTAP is an arts colony. You got a bunch of artists coming together as well as people who have technical expertise to make these decisions to take into consideration the patient's goals, preferences, values. We know that chronologic age is not a great marker for risk necessarily all the time. Certainly it is to some extent, but not perfectly. And so to take all those things into consideration, to put that together, to see it in that format is immensely valuable. And I think that's a really strong endorsement of coming to a place like the University of Washington where that's what you're going to get. You're going to get a very nuanced perspective on this very nuanced condition that many patients have to deal with.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And again, this is where certainly I'm committed, and I think most of the folks that really specialize in cardiac aortic surgery, this is where being a little bit more than just a pure, you know, aortic surgical technician comes into play, right? Because the scenario you described, there's also the inverse of that. So maybe a younger patient that comes in who absolutely doesn't meet traditional criteria, but for a variety of reasons, you know, sometimes psychologically, you know, someone comes in who is just their quality of life is very severely impacted by the fact that they have an aortic aneurysm. Well, okay, if that person is, you know, several millimeters away from meeting criteria, I mean, how do you adjudicate that in that particular situation, right? And this is where you have to sit down and say, look, this is what the guidelines are. This is what I think the risk of your aneurysm is untreated right now. And this is what surgery would look like, right? And the bottom line is if you can do surgery safely, right? And if you've self-audited you and your program and you know what your outcomes are for these particular things, then you can have an honest conversation with somebody that comes in and say, this is what you're looking at. You know, the risk is low, but it's not zero. And we can help you put this, you know, behind you. And so sometimes you're having that conversation, right, and sort of redirecting somebody in one particular way. So the complexities here are tremendous sometimes, you know, and this is what's so fun for me to treat so many different patients from diverse backgrounds, but also, you know, various ages. You know, I treat teenagers all the way up to people in their 80s and 90s, and you know, we're addressing pregnancy issues and you know, family planning, and all the way up to sort of, you know, near end of life, you know, situations and kind of everything in between. And to me, that's fun. That it makes it fun. I mean, yes, the operations are great, and it's enjoyable and gratifying to do that. But to actually be someone's, you know, doctor, you know, again, sort of one small cog in their overall sort of healthcare team, I think is very rewarding. And I think those are some of the more the deepest connections that I've had with patients.
That's just phenomenal. It's wonderful to hear what drives you about this or what floats your boat in a way. But I got to pivot then and ask, why fly fishing?
So the short answer is, of all my hobbies and sort of pursuits and things, the one time that I found myself where I wasn't thinking about work was fly fishing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean to actually turn off, right, and not think about First Wave Ross or what case I have next Tuesday or whatever it is. The only true time that I felt sort of free from that, if you will, was fly fishing.
When did you discover fly fishing?
During training.
Hmm.
Yeah, during training. And so, you know, for example, skiing, I'd be sitting on a chairlift thinking about all these things. You know, ditto with hiking or camping. And those are all great things that I love and enjoy as well. But if I, for a time to really connect with nature and sort of connect with myself and sort of what I'm doing and sort of re-energize and refocus myself, that was it. I mean, that was my sort of escape from things. So that's probably, you know, on top of the fact that you get to do it in beautiful places, you get sort of this really intimate interaction with nature that I think few other pursuits do. And I got into it very, very randomly living out here in Seattle, and boy, it didn't take long till I was tying flies. And I mean, my wife can tell you about the collection of fly rods we have in the basement piling up. But again, this sort of, as they say, the rest is history. I truly believe that for all of us, right, it's important to identify, you know, things that you can do to turn off for a little bit. You can't do this pedal, you know, to the metal 24/7. You just can't. I mean, we work hard. We do a lot of work here. We operate on a lot of patients. We see a lot of patients. And you have to be able to turn off occasionally and recharge. I mean, we actually owe that to our patients. So whatever it is, I mean, for me, it's fly fishing. You know, now with youngsters, you know, it's kind of introducing them to some of these things, which is a real kind of recharge and boost for me. But whatever it is, I always encourage the trainees to find passions, you know, outside of medicine, because there's room to do this at an extremely high level, but also create some time for yourself.
That is really well said.
A couple other quick hot fire questions here. What music, if any, do you play while you operate?
So we do listen to music in the operating room. I will often sort of gauge the personnel that's in the room and sort of tailor. At this point, our team is small enough, and we work with the same individuals enough that I kind of know the music tastes of most of the nurses and folks in the room. That said, if I'm choosing the music, we listen to a lot of reggae. I find that reggae is a nice thing to have, kind of relaxing thing to have in the operating room. On top of that, a lot of kind of classic rock things. So, you know, Fleetwood Mac, even kind of Rolling Stones types of things. For me, you know, in the operating room at least, not a lot of hip hop, nothing that's too kind of loud and aggressive and distracting. It needs to be just kind of sort of soothing and sort of, I hope, help create kind of a relaxed environment for folks.
You're zen. Yeah. Your favorite part of the Ross procedure? The buttons, the...
Well, my favorite part of the Ross procedure is when the clamp comes off and everything works.
Good
and then the patient goes home in one piece. The Ross procedure is a little bit of a labor of love. It's it's one of those things that when you're in the moment, it's a bit of a grind. I mean, you have to be on your A-plus game, you know, for several hours, which seems like, well, you're always on your A-plus game, but you're actually really on your A-plus game. Very, very focused on small minutia, and that can be a little bit tiring. But it's beautiful. I mean, it's a beautiful thing to watch it come together. You know, once we suture the autograft into the aortic annulus and you look at the leaflets, you know, and you've got nice deep leaflets that coapt well, and you kind of know at that point that this is going to be really good, right? And if as long as, you know, nothing gets screwed up here, you know, this may be very, very good for a long time. But then, I mean, the best part is when it looks good, you know, and you can go out and tell the family, hey, things look really good. You know, we're right where we want to be. And, you know, a few hours later, you're talking to the patient and saying everything looked great. And I think you're going to be in really good shape.
Do you remember the moment or thing that you knew you wanted to either be a doctor, surgeon, or cardiac surgeon?
Yeah, that's a good question. That comes up a lot. I, you know, this was not something where, you know, at a young age, I said, you know, by golly, if I'm not a heart surgeon, you know, I'm a total fail. I mean, this was nowhere on my radar. I mean, the bottom line is, you know, in college, I gravitated towards biology and science and things like that. And it had, you know, I have a few physicians and dentists in the family. So I'm the youngest of five. So I'm blessed with having a very close relationship, you know, with older siblings who served not only as siblings, but also, you know, mentors and role models. And actually, I recall a conversation with my mom when I was an undergrad about, you know, I think I'm leaning towards dentistry, or it's maybe dentistry or medicine. And she kind of pulled me aside and was like, well, you know, dentistry is great, but you are sort of focused on the mouth and the teeth, right? Whereas medicine, there's all these different things, you know, that you can do. And that resonated with me, you know, and ultimately I chose to go into medicine. Again, very, very open about what I would ultimately do. Sort of fortuitously, on my surgical rotations in my third year, I was on the thoracic surgical service, and it felt like a very good sort of personality fit, and I thought that the cases were really interesting, and that led me to do a cardiac surgical rotation in my last year, and it's pretty much on day one of that, I knew that I was pretty much sold there. And yeah, I think a lot of it is the obvious parts of heart surgery, right? That you have this close bond with a patient and you know, hopefully restore health and all those things. I think that's certainly true. For me, part of it is, you know, enjoy working with my hands, right? This is part of the reason, going back to fly fishing, I love fly tying. I mean, that creativity and sort of creating something that's useful with my hands. I get to do that for a living. And I think it's, to me, it's very cool to restore function of something. So you take, for example, a leaky heart valve, right? And instead of just cutting it out and replacing it, which is perfectly interesting and has a positive impact as well, but to actually restore function of something and use these principles to reproducibly have this positive impact and restore the functionality of a valve is amazing. And it's challenging, you know, it's humbling. And I feel like most days, pretty much every day I go to the operating room, I get a little bit better. And I like that. I mean, I never feel complacent. I mean, it never feels easy. That has probably led to pretty much the absence of any non-gray hair left on my head. But to me, that's professionally gratifying. I mean, it's fun to be challenged every single day, and it never feels like I just have to go through the motions to get through the day.
Now, Chris,
I have one last question.
One last question. Yeah.
How many times for Halloween or how frequently do you wear a Superman costume under your suit?
Never.
Seems like a missed opportunity.
The
curl, the glasses. He is our Clark Kent of the division.
True.
That would not pass my wife's approved Halloween costumes. Any kind of Superman type of thing would be vetoed. So no. It's all humility is extremely important in this line of work, because if you don't humble yourself, you will be humbled by the line of work. And so I know that's not where you were going with your question, but that's why there would be no Superman.
It's a good answer.
Chris, thank you so much. Thank you not just for being on the podcast today and explaining the Ross procedure and all of the other things you did, but thank you for the work that you do on behalf of patients. Thank you for having an artist's mentality, and thank you for inspiring the next generation. You do all that every day. You did that here today. And we're so glad to have you.
Patients are lucky too. Thank you.
Yep.
Well, thank you both. It's been a lot of fun, and I think it's a useful conversation, and it's always fun to reflect on these things. I think we don't allow ourselves enough time to reflect on what we do and why we do it. And honestly, it's fun to talk things through with you. So thank you both.
Wonderful. Thank you.